You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
David Mamet, who won a Pulitzer Prize for Glengarry Glen Ross, has also written over 30 screenplays, including The Verdict and Wag the Dog. He's directed a dozen movies, such as The Spanish Prisoner, State in Maine, and Heist. And these days, he's producing and writing for the CBS hit series The Unit. But he somehow found the time to put together a new collection of essays about the movie industry. The book, Bambi vs. Godzilla, on the nature, purpose, and practice of the movie business, is published by Pantheon. I'm very pleased it has brought David Mamet back to my show today. Hello.
So it's
a pleasure to see you.
Didn't
most of the essays in this book first appear as articles in Harper's and The Guardian?
I think about half of them did. And The Guardian asked me to be a film critic. I said, I don't want to criticize films. They said, well, I know you're very opinionated. Would you care to, like, write every month on any subject that's could be termed film-related? So I did. And so I took about half of those over a two-year period and looked like a book. And what seemed to be the thread running through, I think, was two things. One, if I may, is with my kind of I'm wackily enamored of the movie business. I mean, not just of movies. I love movies, but the business. It's and the other thing is my trying to understand that aspect of the business, which is the business part of show business. So I'm trying to address both of those things in the book.
I guess we shouldn't be surprised that the man who wrote Glengarry Glen Ross is interested in business. But the business side of the arts is different than real estate. Or is it?
Well, no. It really isn't. I was talking to my wonderful stepmother, Judy, in Chicago. She read the book Bambi the other day, and she said the most wonderful thing. She said, you know, Dave, I'm so proud of you. It's a real populist book. So I hadn't thought of it that way, but coming from myself being a Chicagoan and she being a Chicagoan, it's very high praise indeed. And when I was coming up, the people who influenced me were the populist, the Midwestern writers, and many of them were writing about business. So the traditional writing about, you know, Frank Norris and Theodore Dreiser and Sherwood Anderson and Sinclair Lewis, they were writing about what is it about America that makes us what we are? And the Midwestern answer is, it's business.
And you told an interviewer that you'd been reading a lot of political economic theory. So
that's right.
What are we talking about, Karl Marx or Milton Friedman?
Both. I've been reading Karl Marx. I've been reading Milton Friedman.
Do they both apply to the film industry?
Absolutely. And I've been reading a lot of the contemporary, I guess they're conservative economists and conservative thinkers. For example, Thomas Sowell, notably, and he took me back to Friedrich Hayek and his 1944 book called The Road to Serfdom. And Victor Davis Hanson and Shelby Steele. And what these guys are talking about, which I found interesting, is what do the conservatives mean? It's all new to me. You know, I'm a red diaper baby. You know, my dad is a labor lawyer. What do the conservatives mean when they're talking about the free market? And why is it that in these guys' views, the free market is what made and makes America great? And the idea is that people are all what we're trying to do is level the playing field so they can go out and, you know, make their own mistakes.
But when I speak to people who work in foreign film industries, they always say that we have a better situation than you do because we get government support, and so we can make films that don't have to make a lot of money, don't have to be blockbusters.
Yeah, but this looks like it's a really great idea, but take it from somebody who spent 40 years in show business, it's a rotten idea. And why is it? Because the essence of the interchange, the artistic interchange, is between the artist and the audience, neither one of whom has to describe the reason for his preference to uninterested third parties. This is what Milton Friedman's talking about. It's what Hayek's talking about. He says the question is not what is decided, because everyone's going to make mistakes. The question is at what point it's decided and who gets to make the mistakes. So what all these conservative economists say, what I've tried to address in the book, is that the essence of free market economy is to take out the middleman. If you can put it on, you don't have to explain to the government why it's a good idea. You roll the dice, right? If the audience likes it, they don't have to explain to you why they like it. You don't have to be able to articulate the reasons for your choice, which means that people can change their minds very, very quickly. If you don't have look, for example, a subscription to a theater seems like a very good idea. Oh, I get it. I'll get five plays for the price of six or whatever the heck they say. But in practice, it's not a very good idea because the audience is committed up front to they have a vested interest in wanting to like what that theater puts on. So the essence of the theatrical interchange was, wow, I want to go see that. I don't know why. Gets taken out of the equation.
I'm surprised that someone from Chicago, somebody who grew up with, I guess, in the environment of Steppenwolf and the Goodman Theater, would say something like
that. Yeah, but see, this guy Danny Newman came around in Chicago and he wrote this book called Subscribe Now, and it's a good idea. It seems like it's a good idea, but you don't get great theater. And in the era in which I came up in Chicago, when Steppenwolf was there, and I was there with Billy Macy and the Organic, and Dennis Franz was there, and Stuart Gordon and all those guys, and they did Grease. Those weren't subscription theaters. They were little kids screwing around in a garage.
What kinds of people are attracted to the business side of movie making? I ask that because I have this little quote. You say, this is the answer. The successfully matriculated executive, marginally concerned with art and diminishingly concerned with product, devotes his new wisdom and increased leisure to opportunities for trickery, greed, stock manipulation, and merger, as in any business. In the film business, one department of this glee is called the development process. This is the fig leaf of propriety covering, if I may, not the genitals of artistic potential, but the empty space where they once lay. Now, that sounds to me like a statement from somebody who believes the total opposite of what you've just been saying about the free market.
No. What I'm saying is one of the things I say in the book is that what's wrong with the movie business is wrong with what's wrong with any successful business. General Motors starts out with 15 companies of guys in a garage making cars. Some of them get successful. Some of them fall by the wayside. The ones who are successful buy each other out and merge. And the original guys who were making the cars are now gone. And now they start bringing in managers. And what the managers say is what managers always say. You know, we need more managers. And so just like the Defense Department, just like General Motors, the movie business is no different. That when you lose sight of the original interaction, which is put the asses in the seats and make them want to come back tomorrow night, what you get is the development process.
And you say that the kind of person destined to succeed in this corporate culture is the young bureaucrat who learns that success comes not from pleasing the audience, but from placating the superiors above him.
Yeah, well, that's true. And here's the thing about show business. It's to succeed in show business, it's not impossible, but it's very rare to do it if you start late. And the reason is you can't learn the lessons late. You got to learn them when you're 15, 16, 20. And you go to college, it's mainly too late. If you go to graduate school, it's absolutely too late because you got to get out there and get kicked in the shins.
Also, you got to watch people stick each other in the back with knives. Well, because you say that they first have to kiss the boss's butt, but then at a certain point know when it's the right time to betray the boss.
Yeah. Now, listen, it's not that the theater business is that the movie business is a business of a bunch of swine. It's not. It's a business. You know, it's a great business, and what I'm talking about, one of the things I'm talking about the book is the way in which I see that business maturing and some of the Department of the Navy is going to want to build nuclear submarines. Why? Because they're the Department of the Navy. Somebody who went to Annapolis wants to dedicate his or her life to the Department of the Navy is going to want a Navy with more nuclear submarines, whether or not the country needs them. It doesn't mean that they're depraved traitors. Quite the contrary. They're caught up in the essential infrastructure and the essential lessons of what's going to preserve their place in the world.
I'm speaking with David Mamet, whose latest book is Bambi versus Godzilla on the Nature, Purpose, and Practice of the Movie Business. It's published by Pantheon. But you're sounding a lot more friendly toward these people than the way you come across in this book. In fact, Steve Martin wrote for your dust jacket, David Mamet is supremely talented. He's a gifted writer, an observer of society and its characters, and I'm sure he'll be able to find work somewhere, somehow, just no longer in the movie business.
Yeah, bless him, bless his little cotton socks. He's being very friendly and ironic.
But people will take offense unless you're sure that they won't, because they don't find their names in the index, and I gather that's what usually happens in Hollywood. They look for their name in the index. If it's not there, they say this book is worthless.
Well, look, you know, quote me something that somebody would take offense at. Go ahead.
Well, you just said that these guys are all, they all kiss the boss's butt, and then they eventually betray him.
Well, of course.
You think people take that as a compliment?
Well, it's not the book is not a settling up of scores. What I'm trying to do is look from someone who's arguably on the inside, arguably on the outside, at the way of a corporate system works, and that's the way any corporate system works.
You also have a theory that Hollywood directors suffer from Asperger's, which is a form of autism.
That's not what I said. What I said was that it's not impossible. It is not impossible that a cultural or genetic disposition, which happens to have been found, the genetic disposition, which is a bunch of symptoms, which conjoined are called Asperger's syndrome, and is found almost exclusively in Ashkenazi, which is to say Eastern Jewish males, who happen to make up almost exclusively to this date the bulk of movie directors.
But so, you say Asperger's syndrome helped make the movies.
I say it's not impossible that Asperger's syndrome. Yeah, don't lose your sense of humor, Leonard. You've got a lot of people who are relying on you.
Well, I don't direct films, and I would have loved to have gone in the film business, but I guess I wasn't ruthless enough. First, I wasn't willing to kiss up to somebody. I had to learn that much later in life, unfortunately. I don't think I was made to be in the film business, even though I love movies too, and wrote film scripts when I was a kid.
Well, you know, not many people are, but you know, it's the people who like it love it. I love it.
Well, you're an Ashkenazi Jew, so do you see yourself as being Asperger's?
Well, here's the thing: there's a wonderful book by Thomas Sowell, who's a spectacular economist and a social historian. I don't know if he'd characterize himself as such, but he is. He's by training an economist. And he wrote a marvelous book called Ethnic America. It came out about 30 years ago. And what he's trying to do is look at the behavior of certain ethnic groups in this country. By the way, Dr. Sowell himself is an African-American. He's trying to look at the behavior of certain ethnic groups in this country and see where their cultural behaviors came from, and he says, and what he does is he traces seven of them back to their roots overseas. And he says, that's what we're looking at. He says, you're not looking at something that happened because they're, quote, immigrants. He says, look, the Irish behave differently than the Italians behave differently than the Jews behave differently than the African Americans. Where did these different behaviors come from? And what he says is they're thousands of years old. Now, when we're talking about the Ashkenazi Jews, my people, in Poland, prized learning above all things. They prized the ability to retain vast amounts of information and to make wonderful, bizarre connections and to improvise, and they passed this on to their kids. The boys who were the best at this, the Talmudic scholars, were found early and nurtured, and they got to marry the rich girls, right? They got to marry into the rich families, the Hasidic dynasties intermarried, so that what you have is certainly a cultural disposition toward the kind of things that make a movie director. Wait a second, I'm almost done. And perhaps a genetic disposition.
So where does Mel Gibson fit into this?
He's not Jewish?
Well, maybe he is, although he did make a movie, one of the highest grossing films of all time.
He made a movie about Jesus,
guy.
Right?
Yeah.
And Jesus was Jewish, right? So maybe he is Jewish.
Ah. And Clint Eastwood?
Yeah. Well, no. Look at. Obviously, there are a lot of non-Jews in the movie business. But the number of Jews in the movie business is vastly disproportionate to our number in the general population.
Neil Gabel has claimed that they invented Hollywood in the early days.
Well, of course he claimed they invented it, because it's true. I mean, Fox, and Schenck and the Warner Brothers and Lemley and Goldwyn and Louis B. Mayer, they're all Ashkenazi Jews, every one of them. And his wonderful book, Gabler's book, An Empire of Their Own, says if you draw a circle like 300 miles around Warsaw, 300-mile radius, all the guys who invented the movie business came from there.
My guest is David Mamet, and his latest book is a collection of essays about the film business, a business he's been involved with in recent years. It's called Bambi versus Godzilla, on the nature, purpose, and practice of the movie business. It's published by Pantheon. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with David Mamet, whose latest play. Wow. Do you have a new play, David?
Well, I got a play I adapted. It was a 1905 play by Harley Granville Barker called The Voysey Inheritance. It's running at the Atlantic.
We did a segment on it with some of the stars. I just thought it was fabulous. And I thought that your adaptation really made it relevant to the current situation. The actors loved what you'd done as well, so you got a lot of praise that day.
Thank you.
Well, the book is Bambi versus Godzilla on the Nature, Purpose, and Practice of the Movie Business, published by Pantheon. And we've been talking about some of the positives and negatives of the film business. You make the claim that hangers-on and peripheral players of the movie industry have dragged down the art of film over the years. And you include not only the growing number of, I'm quoting, useless, venal producers, but also, as you pointed out earlier, film critics. You call them a plague. What would you replace film critics with?
Well, I wouldn't. I mean, here's the thing. Everybody, if we think in the abstract, we say, well, how dare one criticize some aspect of that business from which Dave gets his bread. But everybody bitches about their boss. That's part of the American way. And when you put on the boss hat, as many people wear two hats, you know, you bitch about the employees. That's part of the American way.
Well, there are some critics who really know a lot about movies, and there are some who obviously don't. Do you separate the two?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I say in the book, and it's true, that I've profited greatly from many lessons I've learned from some critics. I don't want to name them for fear of being thought meaching, but that the hard fact of I've dealt with critics all my life. I made my living in show business all my life, and critics are, you know, they're like ants at a picnic. They're there, you know, they're entitled to make their living.
And some of them have given you great reviews.
Yes, that's true. But the great reviews are never good enough, and the bad ones are devastating. But once in a while, one does learn from a critic, but one has to change one's expectations. The idea is not that the critics are there. They aren't there to help me, and most of them aren't there to help the movie business. Neither should they be. They're there to sell newspapers, and that's their gig. God bless them.
Well, there was a time when critics actually had some impact on the audience for a film. If a critic praised a film, it was likely to do well. Now critics slam a movie like the two biggest films of the last weekend. They both got awful reviews, and they probably should have. And they raked in millions of dollars.
Yeah, you know, the movie business, it's a fascinating business. And just like, you know, if you run away and join the circus, it's going to rain on the tent sometimes and you might get stepped on by the elephant. There's a price for everything, you know. And one of the prices of being in show business is uncertainty, and another one's critics.
You say also that the industry is being ruined by anyone dumb enough to go to film school in the hope of becoming a filmmaker.
Yeah.
You taught at Yale and NYU?
I didn't teach film. I got a writing fellowship at Yale many, many, many years ago to work in the drama school. And I was supposed to teach playwriting, but I realized I didn't know anything I could teach about playwriting. So I kind of thought about it, talked about a unified field theory of aesthetics.
Well, you're kind of an autodidact yourself, aren't you? Didn't you recently receive the Carl Sandburg Award for the Chicago Public Library because you had spent so many hours when you were younger teaching yourself in that library?
Yeah, I was very touched by that. That's kind of where I got what little education I have was roaming through the stacks at the Chicago Public Library.
So do you think that that's the way people should really learn?
It's the only
way.
It's the only way
anyone learns. I could go to somebody and say, I have a great idea for a movie.
Yeah.
Give me, I don't know how many millions of dollars. It's not likely, is it?
Well, it's unlikely whatever you do, but going to film school is not going to make it more likely.
Getting back to business, in the first essay using Marx's theory of surplus value, you pose the question, who is the film by? There's a two-tier system in the movie business,
that's right.
You say. And you also, even though you're a red diaper baby, feel that the unions are one of the problems?
Not necessarily. No. I speak. No. What I say is this: there's a marvelous friction going on in any business, right? The unions, of course, want to protect their membership, and the heads of the unions want to protect their job. The producers may want to make good movies, and they want to protect their job. And it's the American way. One the unions would love to do away with capital, and capital would love to do away with the unions, and they got to get under and fight it out.
And then you say sometimes they are working across purposes. You tell an anecdote about speaking to a prop master about an ill-behaved star who, to lighten the mood, or perhaps in a transport of jollity, you say, took to dancing in combat boots on the roof of his brand new Mercedes, on the prop master's Mercedes. And he didn't think there was anything wrong and didn't think that he should pay for all the damage that he had done.
Yeah, well, one sees very, very odd things making a movie.
Yeah, well, there are inequities, is what you're saying.
Well, yeah, there's inequity. In what does one not find inequities? Sure, there are.
Well, how much of this is the fault of the actors themselves, or directors treating actors as though they are special gods?
Here's the thing: on the set, the ethic of work on the set is kind of marvelous. Everybody works very, very, very hard indeed. The actors who are, once in a while, someone who is ill behaved and can't be fired, makes an ass of him or herself, just as they do in any business.
Well, you protect yourself by only hiring the same 20 actors.
Well, and sometimes I worked with a lot of, I got kind of a rep company I work with, but I worked with a lot of people.
Do you think, since you are critical often of actors, of producers, of directors, that screenwriters should be exempt from the criticism?
I don't think that I've ever been critical of actors. What I have been critical of is bad behavior. And as I say in the book, I find that very, very seldom among the movies are made on a two-tier system. Above the line are the people who are considered to contribute to the funding, the producers, the writer, the director, and the stars, and the below the line is everybody else. And the work ethic and below the line is, it's rather spectacular. Everybody works hard, nobody complains. Once in a while, somebody who is on the set and above the line, and that would be the actor, may misbehave. But they don't do it because they're an actor, they do it because they're ill-mannered.
But then you also don't like the way some people act. Laurence Olivier is somebody whose work you don't admire.
Yeah, but he's dead, you know, so let's...
It's interesting. For years, he was the actor most people cited as the great one. And more I'm hearing criticism of him in recent years. Is it because he's dead, do you think, or because our taste in acting styles has changed?
Well, taste in acting styles change. And what I say in that essay, the one essay you're referring to, is people say, might say, oh, yes, Laurence Olivier, great actor. But you mentioned Tony Curtis and people smile. And that's the difference.
And Tony Curtis is a really good actor.
I think he's a great actor.
What about, and you love Paul Newman.
Yeah, I adore Paul Newman. I got to work with Paul Newman.
And is that because these are actors who have good attitude or because they just give you what you want?
No. I love them because I see their acting and I see something human in them.
Gene Hackman is another one.
Gene Hackman. I got to work with Don Ameche, Gene Hackman. Yeah, James Mason.
Well, since you also feel that actors should just deliver the lines as they're written, I wonder about working with James Mason, who always seemed to find something underneath it. I mean, he seemed to me to be the ideal actor for somebody who could really understand a character on many levels. I thought his version of Lolita was the ultimate. It was obvious that he had actually read the book.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying the actor shouldn't understand the character on many levels. I'm just saying that the best way to bring that about is to say the lines as written.
What about actresses other than Rebecca Pidgeon?
Well, I don't want to name... I've worked with a lot of wonderful actresses, too. I don't want to get into naming names because, I just picked on Laurence Olivier because he's dead and because he made my flesh crawl.
You're right. I don't think Hollywood has gone bad. It's the same as it's always been. So all of this has been... It's been this way since the silent days?
Absolutely. Nothing changes in Hollywood. I mean, you read my book, you read William Goldman's book, Adventures in the Screen Trade, you read Ivor Montague's book, With Eisenstein in Hollywood. All of the Hollywood, the insider looks at Hollywood are all the same because the business is just the same.
So obviously you're not upset when reviewers compare you to William Goldman, or what about Sidney Lumet's book, Making Movies?
Yeah, but again, Sid's telling the same stories.
Mm-hmm. Because when you're inside it, you see the film business differently. This is like being an athlete who understands baseball in a way that I could never understand it as a fan.
You can't know. I'm sure it's like being in love or being in a war. You can't know what's going on unless you've been there. You just have no idea. And what I hope comes across, and I think comes across in the book, is I always thought that being there was a great, great privilege, and a lot, and the most fun in the world.
What about the title of your book? It comes from an animated short called Bambi Meets Godzilla, Bambi versus Godzilla, in which Bambi innocently nibbling on flowers is stomped by Godzilla.
Yeah.
So, how do you see yourself? Are you Bambi or Godzilla in this?
Well, story? I don't know. I always thought I was Bambi because who wouldn't want to be Bambi, you know?
But you don't want to be stomped by Godzilla.
Don't want to be except for the getting stomped by Godzilla part.
So, do you to make it? Do you have to be both? Do you think?
I have no idea. You got to be persistent. You know, you got to have kind of a thick skin and a little bit of a sense of humor. And I hope I'm some of those things.
Well, you said that Hollywood's always been the same, but many people will tell you that movies just aren't as good as they used to be. Have you seen films that you really like this year?
Yeah, many people also tell you that the Earth's getting hotter. I mean, it doesn't make it true.
You don't believe the Earth is hotter?
No, of course it's getting hotter. No, but here's the thing. I mean, I think last year they made 250 films out of Hollywood, right? 40 years ago, they made 3,300. Mm-hmm. So obviously, I think the percentage of great films and the percentage of good films is the same, but the actual number is decreasing, so boo-hoo.
Well, what we're seeing now is, in the old days, the studios would make big blockbusters, and then they would make films that were somewhere middle priced, and then they would make very minimally budgeted films. Now we either have the indies or we have the studios doing the big blockbusters.
Yeah.
And there doesn't seem to be anything in between.
Well, you got to remember that all the studios had a lot. Very few of them have a lot anymore. And so what they had was a marginal price. They had some time when they had the lot anyway. They had the actors under contract anyway. They weren't paying the writers anything. They say, well, what the heck? You know,
well, they had Faulkner. They're paying Faulkner and F. Scott Fitzgerald nice salaries.
Yeah, unfortunately, but they say let's make a bunch of little movies for the marginal price. So now every movie it's got to float on its own bottom.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that's good? After all, that sounds like something Milton Friedman would think is a good idea.
Well, here's what Milton Friedman would think is a good idea: is that the movies have to be nimble. They don't have subsidy. They shouldn't have subsidy, thank God. They got to be nimble. And so the more nimble operation is going to bring home the money.
But in the old days when the studio system worked, and everybody says those were the golden days, wasn't there a subsidy of a sort? Because the big movie would subsidize the art film.
Yeah, but that's different because that's what Milton Friedman would say is a subsidy was going to uninterested, trying to articulate your position to disinterested third-party observers. So it was the movies all started out as a ma and pa store, and some of them persisted that way for a long time. That meant that the people who were making the decisions were betting their own money. And so if something didn't work, they were going to change their minds pretty quick.
D.W. Griffith actually gave us the first blockbuster, as far as I can tell.
Yeah. Porky's?
Yes. You write that the public doesn't really want to see big blockbusters. Really?
I don't think so. I think
aren't they the ones that bring in all the money? I mean, you look at the returns after a weekend, and it's almost always the blockbuster, not that wonderful art film that got the great reviews.
Yeah, I don't care about
not
art films.
But you make, I mean, that would mean you too. You never had a monster hit, did
you? No, I haven't. Not yet.
Did you imagine that they would be when you made them?
Oh, sure. I mean, I, along with every other filmmaker, thinks that, boy, that movie's going to come out on Friday night, and people are going to eat their young. Right? They're going to tear out their livers and eat their livers on the sidewalk outside, weeping, oh, my God, now I can die happy because I've seen Dave's current film.
You don't like sequels on the whole. About one particularly bad one you wrote, Jewish law states that there are certain crimes that cannot be forgiven as they cannot be undone. It lists murder and adultery, and I add this film.
Yeah.
But where would movies be without murder and adultery? In fact, there would be no film noir tradition, would there?
I think that you're massively missing my point.
No, I'm not. I'm just giving you a hard time.
Yeah, murder and adultery, yeah. I mean, Pauline Kael, I mean, pretty good writer, and one of her collections of essays sums it up. It was called Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang. That's what the movie's about.
In the last part of the book, you write about the campaigns for the Oscars. The Oscars are coming up.
Yeah.
What happens during those campaigns?
Well, you know, my temple, God bless him, threw a gala. And so we all, you know, we had a theme. I can't remember what it was. It was like penguins or Bavarian farm life or some damn thing. And so we all went to the thing and we threw the gala. And there's vastly talented people in the gala. But every gala is the same, whether it's the Grammys or My Temple or somebody's Boy Scout troop or the Oscars. So you have the best entertainers in the world throwing the Oscars. And it's a gala. Which is, well, let's all run around like chickens without our heads cut on and thank each other for an hour and a half.
Well, for years it was assumed that anything that Miramax released would wind up getting an Oscar because Harvey Weinstein would really campaign heavily for his stars and his films.
Yeah.
To some degree, that still happens with Harvey, but he doesn't seem to have had the success. So how do people campaign for Oscars and how do you succeed?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the Oscars are, except it's a bunch of people thanking each other. Would I like to win one? Yeah, sure.
Have you been to any of them?
Yeah, I won twice. I got nominated twice. I didn't win. And a huge, huge miscarriage of justice. And I'd like to ask your listeners, after they subscribe to your thing, to write in. It's the American Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. And I think if we got enough letters, say, I know that these movies were like 10, 15 years ago, would it be possible to reverse that decision?
Well, they could do it the other way. They could give a Lifetime Achievement Award.
No. A Lifetime Achievement Award means shut up and sit down.
Oh, is that it?
Of course, as you know.
You seem to have only liked one film this year. It's up for an Oscar.
Yeah.
And it's maybe the most divisive film of the year. There are critics who adored Borat, and there were critics who absolutely reviled it.
Yeah. But none of them actually said, or unless I missed it, that it's based on Two Gentlemen of Verona.
And it is?
Oh, yeah. You didn't know that? I mean, he's a great classicist. Sacha Baron Cohen's a great classicist.
I mean, it may be. I thought it was laugh until your sides split funny,
yeah.
But it was also perhaps the reason some people hate it is because it makes you squirm,
uh-huh.
Which is, I think, is part of what makes it funny, don't you? I mean, there is a squirm factor.
I don't know what makes it funny. It's funny because it's hysterical. I mean, that's good enough for me.
Is it true that you're writing a new musical with Patti LuPone?
I'm writing a musical for Patti LuPone.
Oh. Well... So you'll be writing the musical. What does that mean? Everything, or are you going to get Stephen Sondheim to do the music and the lyrics?
No. I'm doing everything. I wrote the music, the lyrics, and the libretto. And if they'll let me, I'll design the program.
And you've written music before?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I wrote a lot of music with my wife, Rebecca Pigeon. I wrote some music for some of my movies. I love writing music.
It's interesting that a number of directors, I'm not putting you in their class, although maybe you do, but Satyajit Ray, for example, he wrote music for his films. Akira Kurosawa wrote mm-hmm. music for his films. Do you think that there's something about directing films that leads people to also be musical? Is there a link? Is there a musical link?
Well, sure. Well, yeah, of course. I mean, it helps to be a musician, but a film... is basically rhythm. It's a study in rhythm and a study in pictures. It's very, very little to do with dialogue, and so the rhythm, the effective aspect of a film is the rhythm. And so somebody who might be interested in the rhythm of cutting a film might also be interested in the rhythm of music.
And how involved do you get in the cutting of the film? Some directors are there in the editing room and others don't want to know about it.
Oh, I've been very fortunate. I've done all my movies with a spectacular New Yorker woman named Barbara Tulliver. She cut the first two movies with Trudy Shipp. And so we work very closely together and we'll look at dailies and we'll say, okay, this goes there and this goes there. And I'll go to the editing room. Many times she'll say, I know you're going to kill me, but the whole third act should be thrown away. It's a waste of time.
And are you one of those people who follows that thinking about a movie being in three acts, especially since plays these days are all in two acts?
Yeah, sure, because that's how we think. We think in three acts. That's why plays are written in three acts.
Well, they were. And now do you like the idea that three-act plays are now given somehow they figure out a way to break them for two acts?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's not a question of where the intermission goes. It's a question of how the drama progresses.
You also are want to design and do other things with the costumes, or is that just a joke?
No, it's just joking. But I do have a book of cartoons that just came out.
So you draw as well?
Yeah, not really. But my good friend Shel Silverstein got me started cartooning about 20 years ago.
By the way, David Mamet will be speaking with Frank Rich tonight. I imagine that'll be a clash of political ideas. I'm not sure Frank Rich really likes Thomas Sowell. That's tonight at 6:30 at the Lighthouse International Theater at 111 East 59th Street. If you want to know more, like get tickets, you can call 1-888-NYT-1870. And David Mamet's book is called Bambi versus Godzilla. It is subtitled On the Nature, Purpose, and Practice of the Movie Business and dedicated to Barbara Tulliver, the great editor, published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us again.
You're so welcome. Thank you.